From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
What will the U.S. leave behind in Afghanistan? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. When the U.S. military complained that dangerous prisoners were released without trial last week, President Karzai said to stop harassing Afghan courts. At the same time, Karzai is negotiating with the Taliban, creating fears of a new war against women after 12 years of progress. A new president to be elected in April might or might not reach agreement to maintain the U.S. and other Western forces beyond the end of this year. Will there still be support in this country for continued involvement after the longest war in American history? Today's talking point, members of Pussy Riot claim rough treatment after being detained in Sochi. First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Alney back with To the Point. After 12 years and many billions of dollars, the U.S. still wants a residual force to remain when combat troops withdraw from Afghanistan at the end of this year. What's at stake for the Taliban and Afghan women? Will there still be support in this country for continued involvement? Today's talking point, after their high-profile tour of the U.S. and Europe, two members of the Pussy Riot protest band were detained in Sochi today. We'll hear what they and the Russian police had to say after they were released. First, this news update. Despite predictions of failure from leaders on both sides, six world powers began talks with Iran today. The goal is a final settlement on Tehran's contested nuclear program. Vienna is the location of the first round of high-level negotiations since an interim deal was reached in November. United Nations Bureau Chief Louis Charbonneau is there for the Reuters News Service. Good to have you back on our program.
Good to be back.
The Ayatollah Khamenei has said these talks will not lead anywhere, and apparently a U.S. administration official very recently also tamped down expectations by saying it's as likely we won't get an agreement as it is that we will. How do you interpret this? Is this strategy talk?
Well, I think everyone is trying to set up outsiders for the possibility that they might not get a deal. I mean, everyone knows that these negotiations are going to be difficult because the stakes are so high on both sides. The Iranians don't want to give up their nuclear program. They want to keep as much of it as possible. And the United States and its European allies mainly want to have as much of it dismantled as possible. And the Iranians say they don't want to dismantle anything. The Americans and Europeans say that much will have to be dismantled. So it's not going to be easy bridging the gaps in the, you know, desires that both sides have. So, but yes, I mean, each side has to, you know, tell people that they're not going to be giving away too much. And it's interesting that the Iranian supreme leader, even though he said he didn't expect this process will lead anywhere, he also said they're committed to the talks and they're not going to walk away from it. And he made the point that this was something that the Iranians actually initiated. So it's a bit of a mixed bag.
Some question about ballistic missile work came up today.
Yes. This is something that the Americans have mentioned a few times, and the UN Security Council resolutions that are on the books since 2006, several of them say that Iran is banned from doing any ballistic missile work that could be related to nuclear weaponry, right? Ballistic missiles that could ultimately carry a nuclear warhead. But the Iranians have been saying that they're not doing anything related to their ballistic missile program, and they've staked out this position. It's not clear whether they're going to stick with that, but they've said that the talks will only focus on the nuclear program. So the Americans and the Europeans, however, are going to insist that they have to do something to deal with the fact that any such activities that could lead to, you know, nuclear ballistic missiles are illegal under the UN Security Council sanctions resolutions.
The Catherine Ashton, who is overseeing this on behalf of the European Union, is saying that what they're trying to do now is create a framework for future negotiations. So how long is this going to last, and what's it likely to happen next?
I think that this process is going to go on for many months. Originally, the idea was that the period for the interim deal, under which Iran had some limited sanctions relief and agreed to curtail some of its nuclear activities, that process is supposed to be 6 months. And in that 6 months' time, they're supposed to come up with a deal. They have about 5 months left of that 6 months, which will expire at the end of July. And a lot of people think it's going to be extremely difficult for them to get during that six-month period. At the same time, the senior U.S. administration official said yesterday that if they can't get it in 6 months, what reason is there to think that they could get it in another 6 months? Because this deal can actually, the interim deal can be extended by mutual agreement for another half a year. But if they can't get it in 6 months, should we assume they can get it in another 6 months? It's hard to say, but a lot of people are skeptical that this is going to take less than 6 months. People expect it's going to go on much longer than that.
What about the threats in Congress, if threat is the right word, by both Democrats and Republicans to increase sanctions on Iran, or at least indicate that we will increase the sanctions if they don't come to some agreement?
That's a really good point, because if they don't get an agreement in the 6 months that they've set out for themselves by late July, then you can expect that Congress is going to be back threatening sanctions, and it's going to be much more difficult for the Obama administration, if it decides to do so at that time, to tell them to wait yet again. If they have made progress and the outlines of a potential future deal that would be acceptable to all sides is in the making, then you could see there would be strong reason for the Obama administration to go to Congress, and Congress might decide to wait. But the clock is ticking at Congress, and they won't wait forever.
And, of course, there will be congressional campaigns going on, too, as this process drags on. Now, Louis Charbonneau, good to have you on our program again. United Nations Bureau Chief for Reuters, reporting to us from Vienna, where the talks are going on. Great to have you.
Thanks.
In a moment, what will the U.S. leave behind in Afghanistan? On To the Point.
Do you like KCRW on Facebook? If not, you're missing out on the latest music updates, program exclusives, and in-studio video clips. Join the conversation at facebook.com/KCRW.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Herman Olney back with To the Point. Last week in Afghanistan, 65 imprisoned insurgents were released without trial when the U.S. military complained that the men had both American and Afghan blood on their hands. President Karzai accused his nominal allies of harassing the courts of Afghanistan. A coalition official then told the New York Times, "This does feel like that moment when everything changes." Rod Nordland co-wrote the story. He speaks to us from Kabul. Good to have you on our program.
Pleasure to be on.
How do you interpret that statement, that this does feel like the moment when everything changes? And is this release of the 65 imprisoned insurgents a sort of a tipping point?
A lot of people are looking at it that way. I mean, it's been a steady accumulation of things that have spoiled the relationship between the Americans and the Afghans. But this one, they put, the military put so much effort into trying to reverse it and stop it. And it was clear they couldn't do that as strongly as they thought about it. And they made their views known to the Afghans, and they did everything they could. When the Afghans refused to cooperate, to publicly pressure them into doing so, and they didn't. And the military takes it very, very seriously.
What's the evidence? Some of these people have been in prison for a long time. Is the evidence as strong as the military says it is, or do we know?
Well, they've released the evidence, and in some cases it's fairly strong. They say they have biometric evidence, fingerprints, or gunpowder, explosive residue, and that sort of thing, confessions and all. But in a lot of the cases, I think it is probably true that these guys were being facing trial in an American court. The cases would be thrown out summarily, and that's what the Afghans have done. Now, in addition to what evidence they're able to give the Afghans, the Americans also have intelligence information about them, and they claim, you know, this is a war, and these are battlefield captures, and you don't have a standard of evidence that necessarily is the same in court in a war zone that you would have to in a civilian society.
You report that
they can't share that information.
Excuse me. When you report that when these men were released, they were given clothes and warm coats and 5,000 Afghanis. That's about $90, nearly half the base monthly salary of an Afghan police officer. Is that sound to the military, the American military, like they're thumbing their nose?
I think it sounds exactly like that. It's a remarkably generous goodbye present, you know, in the Afghan context. And, you know, remember that money, most of the money in the Afghan budget comes from either American or other aid from our allies. And, you know, I think it's just one more thing that infuriates the Americans. And it's also one more effort by the Karzai administration to show that he's not a puppet and that he's not under American control. And he's trying to send a message to the Taliban in an effort to get peace talks started. I mean, that's what this is all about. The fact is the Taliban don't buy it. There's no evidence so far that all of Karzai's breaks and flights with the Americans have done anything to impress the Taliban. Somebody they can appreciate this.
Rod Nordland in Kabul for the New York Times. A little bit of a fade there on the telephone connection. We'll try to improve that if we can. In the meantime, Michael O'Hanlon is with us. He's director of research for the Foreign Policy Program at the Brookings Institution and a longtime student of American foreign policy. Good to have you on our program.
Thank you, Warren. Nice to be with you.
With Karzai making these overtures to the Taliban, with the courts releasing the prisoners despite what the American troops are saying or American military is saying about the consequences of that, is there any hope for dealing with the Karzai regime? He has not agreed to sign the status of forces agreements, as that will be up to the next president who's elected. Should we just be marking our time until the election's over?
Well, yes, that's the point I was going to make, Warren, because I think your conversation with Rod was very good and helpful, but it also almost overemphasized the importance of anything President Karzai is doing right now. Now, admittedly, 65 bad guys back on the street is not a good thing, and that will endure even after the elections in April. But that contrasts with several thousand who have been arrested or killed over the last 2 or 3 years by the result of combined NATO and Afghan efforts. So we have to remember to keep our patience. We have gotten this far in a difficult relationship with President Karzai, but he is not Afghanistan. There are 11 people running to replace him, all of whom have either publicly or privately, and usually both, supported the bilateral security agreement, supported ongoing cooperation with the United States and the international community. And so we just have to get through these elections and hopefully see a halfway decent and competent person emerge. By the polling I've seen, the chances of that are reasonably good. The top two candidates right now are both people that the Western world knows pretty well and respects and thinks fairly highly of. And so, again, we've come this far. It's too bad that it can't be a little bit happier send-off in our partnership with Karzai, but so be it. You know, the Taliban is strong, but the Afghan army and police are also strong, and they have the support of most of their public. And I think the odds for Afghanistan holding together after this year are actually halfway decent.
Michael O'Hanlon again at the Brookings Institution. Mark Juergensmeyer is director of the Orfalea Center for Global and International Studies at the University of California at Santa Barbara. Good to have you on our program.
Nice to be here.
What do you say to what Michael O'Hanlon is saying? The 11 candidates look like they might be a big improvement on Mr. Karzai. One of them is going to be elected in any case. We should just stay patient.
Yeah, I think this is right. On the other hand, I think it's also true that whoever is going to be elected is going to have to in some way distance themselves from the Americans. And you can regard Karzai as something of a nut, and there may be some evidence to that. But he's a smart nut, and he also knows that the Taliban is going to be around. They're going to be a strong force, that anti-Americanism is extraordinarily strong, not just in Afghanistan, but also in neighboring Pakistan, and that to distance oneself from America and to kind of thumb one's nose to America is not a bad political gesture to take.
What about that, Michael O'Hanlon? Survival, of course, being everybody's primary goal. Might Mr. Karzai, in fact, be at risk himself if he's seen as a puppet of the United States?
Well, Mark certainly articulates the classic worry that Afghan leaders have had, and that very well may be on President Karzai's mind. However, Afghans as a group are not that anti-American, certainly not compared with most of the other countries around them. And if you look at the polling on how people feel about the United States and the international community, it's reasonably positive. And so I think we also might want to consider the possibility of another motive here beyond President Karzai's fatigue and his personality quirks and everything else that Mark rightly alluded to. And the other possibility is that Karzai is sort of throwing a Hail Mary on peace talks with the Taliban. And before we get too critical of him for that, we should remember that we do the same thing once in a while ourselves. So, for example, just in today's paper, you probably saw it, we're talking about increasing the sweeteners in a deal that we would propose to the Taliban, whereby we would release several of their prisoners in exchange for the one soldier from Idaho who's been held by the Taliban, we think now, for close to half a decade, or several years anyway. And so we are looking for this not only as a way to get the soldier Bergdahl back, but also maybe to get the Taliban into a mode of communicating with us and maybe even to have a peace deal. I'm not against that prisoner swap, but there are times where we have really increased our enthusiasm, maybe even a little bit excessively, about what any such gesture could do to jumpstart peace talks that so far have really gone nowhere. So I don't support releasing combatants back onto the battlefield the way Karzai has done these last few days, but I would just take note of the fact that it's not entirely unusual, and we've had some inklings along similar lines ourselves.
Mark Juergensmeyer at the University of California, Santa Barbara, do you agree about the 11 candidates that are running for a president, that there are people there who might, in fact, be more supportive of positions the United States is concerned about, particularly having to do with human rights and women?
Yeah, I think so, but there are two huge elephants in the room, and one, of course, is the Taliban, and the other is Pakistan. Because long after the United States leaves, Pakistan is going to be there, and they're going to be very concerned about what goes on in the region. They famously helped to create the rise of the Taliban in the first place. They certainly have strong connections with the Pashtun community across the border. So I think whoever is going to be taking a leadership role is going to have to be very mindful of their relationship not only with their Islamist brethren within Afghanistan, but with the leadership in Pakistan and how they relate to them. So in both cases, to take too strong a stance towards the United States is going to not particularly help them along. On the other hand, human rights issues and being open to education of women, for example, is something that some Taliban leaders have openly said that they'd be willing to go along with. So it doesn't necessarily mean that this is going to be a horrendous government, but it'll be one, regardless of who wins, who's going to be mindful of its relationship with Pakistan as well as with the Taliban.
Let me go back to Arad Nordland, the Kabul bureau chief for the New York Times. How serious do you think the anti-Americanism is in Afghanistan at this point? And is that a good way of understanding what Mr. Karzai is doing, trying to separate himself from the American involvement?
Now, I think Karzai feeds into a growing anti-Americanism, but it's pretty complicated. I mean, I think one of the factors is concern that the Americans are abandoning them, and I think that feeds a growing anti-Americanism. I mean, just in the last year, and especially the last 2 years, we've seen just an increase in that, and to a great degree, and among groups that didn't exist before. A colleague of mine went to the Panjshir Valley recently, and felt like he was in Taliban territory. The reaction to him was so hostile, and that's something we didn't see before. On the other hand, most of the candidates have declared that they want a bilateral security agreement, and they want to have a good relationship with the United States. So I think there is some hope that whoever wins might well have a better relationship with the United States than we've seen before, although we don't know who's going to win, and that's very much a wild card.
Let me introduce Maniza Naderi, who is Executive Director of Women for Afghan Women, a human rights organization based both in Kabul and in New York. You've set up several institutions for women in Afghanistan. Thank you very much for being on our program today.
Thank you for having me.
How concerned do you think Afghans are, and particularly Afghan women, about what was referred to by Rod Nordland as abandonment by the United States?
Well, Afghan women are very concerned about being abandoned by the United States. A lot of progress has been done over the past 12, 13 years. You know, millions of girls are in school, women are working, there are women parliamentarians, there are women in the government. And, you know, this progress wouldn't have happened with the help of the United States, and it won't keep going if the United States leaves Afghanistan for good.
So you don't buy the idea then that some Taliban even and certainly some of the candidates running for president might in fact want to continue education for women, continue allowing women to serve in the parliament and have a quota of 25%?
Well, the Taliban would never let that happen. That's you know, history has told us what the Taliban stands for. And you know, even in Pakistan a few years ago, the Pakistani government negotiated with the Pakistani Taliban, and at that time they said they were going to let girls go to school. And as soon as that signatures were on paper, they started burning down schools and shooting girls who went to school. So they're not going to agree to any kind of education or equal participation of women in government at all. No, I really don't believe that.
So, Mark Jurgensmeyer, how do you respond to that? You said that even some of the Taliban are favorable. Ms. Naderi says no way.
Well, there's not just one Taliban. I mean, the Taliban has always been a coalition of different groups. And it's entirely possible that there are certain Taliban leaders that say, yes, we admit to the idea of women education, we think that's fine. And then as soon as they sign the decree, then along come another group of Taliban who says nuts to this, and they come in. It's a difficult situation. It doesn't mean that it's absolutely impossible. I mean, look across the border at Pakistan. Pakistan, on one hand, has women running for prime minister. On the other hand, women who run for prime minister get shot. And little girls who try to go to school get shot. At the same time, you have a very modern, sophisticated educated women population in Pakistan. So it's a complicated situation, and my guess is that things are going to be rough for women in Afghanistan after the U.S. withdrawal, but it's not without the possibility of change and reform and openness, particularly in cities like Kabul.
And Ms. Naderi, we need to go to a break, and I'll let you come talk much more when we come back. But very quickly, I take it that you feel that an American continued presence would, in fact, help to make sure that the Taliban leaders who are supportive of women rights might, in fact, be more likely to be in charge, or would they have to be kept out of power altogether?
Well, as far as the women are concerned, we are totally against any form of negotiations with the Taliban because they can't be trusted.
Okay.
And if someone can't be trusted, you know, we don't want to put everything at risk for that.
All right. Hold that thought. We're going to take a break. Later on our talking point, members of Pussy Riot detained and released today in Sochi, claiming they were mistreated by the police. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
Warren Allnayback with To The Point, talking today about the future of Afghanistan subsequent to the presidential election and then subsequent also to the withdrawal of American troops and the fact that so far nobody in Afghanistan has signed the Status of Forces Agreement that would allow a residual force to remain. I want to go back to the issue of women's rights in a moment, but first, Michael O'Hanlon, back to you at the Brookings Institution. One of the reasons for wanting to stay in Afghanistan, as I understand it, is to maintain bases for drones that are targeting al-Qaeda, which is in Pakistan, which we were just talking about at the end of the first section. How important is that, or have we given up the idea of maintaining drone bases in Afghanistan?
It's quite important, Warren, and we would very much like to do it. And it actually raises a broader issue here, which is President Karzai's belief that we desperately need bases in Afghanistan for our future global purposes. And he's sort of half right, because we do very much want, and we acknowledge that we very much want, drone bases in Afghanistan to keep an eye on what's going on in Pakistan and occasionally perhaps to do something about it. But where he's wrong is that he thinks that for watching and perhaps dealing with Iran or even Russia and China, that Afghanistan is crucial to our American and global purposes. And therefore, Karzai thinks he can really maintain this hardline position on negotiations over base access, because ultimately we'll capitulate almost regardless of the terms that he establishes. I think that's another part of the dynamic you have to appreciate in trying to understand where he's coming from. But on the drone specifically, yes, we would very much like to have those bases.
Rod Nordland, back to you, Kabul bureau chief for the New York Times. What's the public opinion, if we know it, about American drone bases in Afghanistan? Is that something that's popular with Afghans, or do they not know about it?
I don't think it's something I don't think it's very much. It's very much on people's radar here, because in most cases, the targets have not been Afghan targets. They've been targets across the border. And attacking across the border is something that's really popular with Afghans. In fact, they've long felt that we should do more. There are a lot of Afghans who would be delighted to see us go to war with Pakistan and feel that's what we should be doing. And that's a theme that Karzai plays to constantly and fairly successfully. You know, why aren't they attacking Pakistan more often? I mean, there have been some drone attacks within Afghanistan, but they haven't created the level of controversy that we've seen across the border and that we've seen from other sorts of attacks inside of Afghanistan.
So, Mark Juergensmeyer, does it then make sense for the U.S. to maintain these bases with drones? Do we have interests beyond Afghanistan that Afghanistan could be helpful with?
Well, this is the maddening thing, because the very things that we think are going to diminish the threat of violence also increases the possibility of it. And within Pakistan, of course, the drone attacks are extremely unpopular and has given rise to some of the most severe anti-Americanism in the country in recent years. It makes it some ways more difficult for Nawaz Sharif and other Pakistani leaders to try to come to some sort of final terms and agreement with Afghanistan, particularly where U.S. is concerned. But on the other hand, because both now Pakistan government and the Taliban have a common enemy in the United States, in some ways it makes them partners. And how can we join together and make it make sure the U.S. don't carry out their drone attacks? At the same time, Pakistan itself benefits from many of these attacks, and it's kind of an open secret that a lot of the attacks are, in fact, concessions to targets that are made by the Pakistan government. But decreasing those attacks would certainly go a long way to improving America's reputation and status within not just Pakistan, but within the subcontinent.
Michael O'Hanlon, back to you at Brookings. What do you think of the 11 candidates running for president in this context? And are they as likely as Karzai to try to negotiate with the United States to maintain bases in Afghanistan, or will that be a political issue?
I think they will be more willing than President Karzai for the most part. Now, again, Rod's living there. I'm sure he wants to maybe add in on this. Let me be brief. Ashraf Ghani is a former finance minister. He spent a lot of years in the West working for the World Bank. He's a very bright guy. He's been an advisor on financial issues to President Karzai and other issues as well, even in more recent times. He is one of the two front runners. The other one, last I saw in terms of the polling, was Abdullah Abdullah, the former foreign minister and runner-up in the 2009 election. Then you have people like the president's brother, and that raises some interesting questions about how well we're establishing democracy if we see a dynasty in the making. But by most accounts, the president's brother is probably somewhat more reasonable than Hamid Karzai. Now, that you can debate that, and there's a lot to say about that issue, but he's not a bad guy just because his name is Karzai. And then there are a couple of others who probably raise more nettlesome questions, like the former warlord Saif, who's been an important politician in recent times but still has those violent roots. And I think even though he's pro-American, we would probably just as soon not see him win. So it would depend on the individual, of course, but the overall thrust of the top tier of candidates is fairly encouraging to my mind.
Rod Nordland, back to you. What about the concern about vote rigging in the election? That issue has been raised, as I understand it, by some of the candidates.
I think that's a concern, you know, and it's always been a concern in Afghan elections. And I think that the international community would be happy to see an election in which, you know, largely it was fairly honest, and nobody expects a very important election. Just how bad it's going to be, it's kind of hard to tell at this point. You know, it's typical when you go to rallies and talk to people who are attending the political rallies to find out that they've been paid just to show up at the rally, for instance. And we see a lot of that from many of the campaigns. But that's kind of almost an Afghan tradition, that vote buying and even buying, paying for people to come and pretend to support you and so on. So it's not going to be a perfect picture at all. I mean, I think it is true that the front runners are fairly pro-BSA and somewhat pro-American, but not necessarily more pro-American than Karzai was, at least originally, in many ways. I mean, Ashraf Ghani's been very critical of the West and the United Nations, and for instance. And his brother, Qayyum, is very pro-American, but he's basically a restaurant operator from Baltimore, and which is what he brings to the party here, which, kind of surprisingly. And yes, they're very pro-BSA, but how pro-American they are in the end we'll have to wait and see about that.
What about the role of women's rights, and has that been important in the election?
I think it's been avoided so far in the election. But I think women are very justly concerned at just what the picture is going to look like, you know, after the election. There have been some laws passed in Parliament recently, which actually Karzai sent back to the Parliament and refused to sign them, that have given women a lot of pause. And none of the candidates are campaigning on women's rights, none of the leading candidates, certainly.
Let me go back to Manisa Naderi, the Women for Afghan Women organization in both Kabul and New York. How concerned are you about the outcome of the election, or do you think it'll make much difference as far as women are concerned?
Well, we hope that it's going to make a difference. We've been trying to talk to the candidates so they can give us their stance on the issue of women, and we're still working with them on that. But Afghanistan is ready for these elections, and Afghanistan is ready for a new government. So the elections happening in April is a very welcome thing, and we hope that it's going to be all for the best.
What about women voters? How many or what percentage of the population of women are women who are registered to vote and likely to participate or try to participate in the election?
Well, you know, 50% of the population or 51% of the population are women, and I'm not exactly sure what percentage of those women are registered to vote, but all women's organizations in Afghanistan right now and the majority of civil society is trying to get the vote out, trying to educate the public on the importance of voting in this election, and we hope that the women's vote is going to be a significant one.
Rod Nordlund, there have been some assassinations of women lately, women officials, women policemen, and is there concern that there will be intimidation at the polls, that they'll try to keep women away from voting?
Away from voting? I think it really depends where. There about a third of the registered voters are women, and that's a huge block of people, and I think that there is a big movement underway among civil society and women's groups to get that vote out on their behalf. And in some places, they'll be very successful. And overall, they're going to be a factor in the elections, or they're trying very hard to be. And some of the candidates have started to take note of that. And certainly, they're all paying lip service to maintaining the gains that women have had. Not all of them, most of them, certainly not Sayoff, who would like to roll everything back to the 7th century and pretty much openly says so. But most of them have been pretty supportive of that.
How likely is he to succeed?
With 11 tickets splitting up the vote, a lot of things are possible, and it's not outside the realm of possibility that he would end up in the runoff. It's unlikely. It's more likely going to be somebody like Ashraf Ghani and Abdullah, perhaps even those two, but it's really hard to say at this point.
Mark Juergensmeyer, again at the Orfala Center for Global and International Studies at the University of California in Santa Barbara. We heard Manisha Naderi say that no negotiation with the Taliban is a good negotiation. But here's President Karzai apparently attempting to reach out to them. They're not going to go away, are they?
They're not going to go away. Look, 2 years from now, let me paint this scenario. And maybe this is extreme, but I don't think it's that extreme if you look at the case of Iraq. And that is, the Americans have gone. Kabul is pretty much the main game in town. Whoever is elected in this, whether it's Abdullah or whoever is elected in the elections, will have a palace guard of 10,000 American troops. He will essentially be mayor of Kabul. Kabul will be a city that allows for a certain amount of moderation, women's rights, and so forth. The countryside is anybody's guess. The Taliban will control some areas. Warlords will control other areas. Pakistan will be trying very hard to have influence over these areas. Whether they will be able to group together in order to form a kind of coalition with the military strength to actually launch an assault on Kabul and take it over the way they did before, I don't know. But I suspect it's going to look kind of like Iraq in a couple years, which is to say it's kind of lumbering along and surviving, but pretty much in name only.
Michael O'Hanlon, does that sound right?
I'm a little more optimistic, although I can't dismiss that scenario. But I think there's also the distinct possibility that most of the big cities and main transportation routes, the main arteries of communication and transit and commerce, remain under government control. There'll be occasional violence. But, the mention of Iraq is a good analogy in some ways. But it's worth noting that Iraq today is somewhere around five times more violent than Afghanistan today. Now, the statistics on both these places are obviously a bit rough, but Afghanistan is at war in the remote countryside. There is the occasional spectacular attack in a big city. But cities like Herat, Mazar-e-Sharif, even Kandahar, the traditional home of the Taliban, have gotten substantially better in a quiet way in the last 2 or 3 years, and they were never that horrible to begin with in terms of raw violence. So that plus the relative cohesiveness of the Afghan army and police make me a bit more optimistic, although I can't rule out Mark's scenario as a plausible if relatively pessimistic one.
Manisha Naderi, back to you with the Women for Afghan Women. We heard that there might be 11,000 American troops there, sort of a palace guard for the president, who's essentially the mayor of Kabul. Does that strike you as a good situation as far as women are concerned, or are you concerned there might not even be those 11,000 U.S. troops?
Well, we need, as far as women are concerned, I think we need the more true American troops as possible, and we've always advocated for that, because Afghanistan at this point is definitely not ready to defend itself. Our police and army, the Afghan police and army is learning and growing, and they're getting better and better, but it's still a new army, and so they definitely need the support of the U.S. government, and you know, that pessimistic view that I just heard isn't a good one, and I hope that doesn't happen. I'm also more optimistic in that Afghans are definitely ready for peace, and they're going to make sure, you know, they're going to do everything they can to achieve peace in the country.
Now, Michael O'Hanlon, how likely is it that the American Congress and that the American people will continue to support a significant presence, even 11,000 U.S. troops in Pakistan? We already have a senator saying that the support is dying away.
It's a great question. Of course, a lot does depend on the quality of this presidential transition in Afghanistan. But it is worth emphasizing, Warren, we're talking about 10% the amount of effort we've been making for the last few years. Now, to some people, that'll just say, well, we've already wasted so much. Why should we even sustain 10% of the previous effort? But for others, they'll say, whatever gains we might have achieved, however limited, however imperfect, however fragile, let's try to protect them with a very modest investment. A big question is going to be, let's say there's 25% uncertainty in the election outcome, just to pick a random number of, you know, possible voter irregularity, fraud, ballot stuffing, et cetera. And then whoever wins in the presumed runoff wins by just 5% margin. Is the international community and are the Afghan people able to accept that outcome as a legitimate one? For all the fraud last time, Karzai was recognized by everybody to be the front runner and the likely winner under any circumstances. That may not be the case here. And so a lot of it's going to be expectations of how you think about the way the next leader of Afghanistan establishes legitimacy. And it's not just going to be who wins the vote, because the voting's going to be imperfect. It's going to be how that person establishes a sense of inclusiveness and also gradual reform to reduce the corruption. If those things happen, I like to hope we'll stick with it over here on this side of the Atlantic as well.
Mark Juergensmeyer, very quickly, Lindsey Graham, South Carolina, has said he may be the only senator left that actually supports an American involvement there, or the only a member of Congress, and that politically it's not a bad idea to say, let's get out of there altogether. What do you think about the political realities here in this country?
I think there would be support for a modest contingent to remain in Kabul, but Michael raises a real specter of political instability. And then there's also the specter that I raised of a regrouped Taliban that's able to mount a major offensive on Kabul in the near future. Now, if either of those things happen, then this 10,000 is going to be more than just a palace guard. They will need to be put to work, maybe to put down an insurrection, maybe to try to keep Kabul from being overrun. They would have to then be supported by others. We'd be back in the war again. And I think it's that fear that people see in the future, not just whether to keep 10,000 present right now, but is this a foothold for an enlargement, an enlarging war in the future? And I think that's what concerns so many people and the reason why it's going to be a bigger debate than we think.
Rod Nordland, back to you with Kabul. In Kabul, what about that prospect of the resurgent Taliban and more warfare?
Well, I think that brings us back to the 65 prisoners that were released last week, and not just those 65, but hundreds of more before that in the past year, and a couple thousand more before that released by the Afghan government. And just how fed up the American military is, because not just because they're upset that these guys that they arrested, they think are bad guys, are back out there, but also because, you know, the whole fundamental approach in the future is to have a small but robust force of special operators who can go out and conduct the sort of raids they've been conducting to arrest Taliban leadership. And they think that's what can keep the wolf from the door ultimately in Kabul. And if they can't do that, or if they're going to do that and just see them sent out a revolving door, they're not very happy about being here. And I think there's been a really big change within the military in their attitude to staying in any form if this is what it's going to look like. Now, hopefully they'll get a better deal from the next presidential candidate, but I think everyone has always felt better to get a deal from this guy that we know for so many years than whatever, you know, unknown factor is going to arise out of the election.
We're going to have to leave it at that. Rod Nordland again, a Kabul bureau chief for the New York Times. Thanks to you. Thanks to Michael O'Hanlon with the Foreign Policy Program at the Brookings Institution. Mark Juergensmeyer at the Orpha Law Center for Global and International Studies at UC Santa Barbara. Manisha Nadari, Executive Director of Women for Afghan Women, a human rights organization based in both Kabul and New York. Thank you all very much for being on our program today. Before the Winter Olympics, Vladimir Putin released two members of the Pussy Riot protest band from prison. Maria Alokhina and Nadia Tolokonikova then toured the U.S. and Europe. Today they were detained by police in Sochi, along with some others. We'll hear more about that in a moment on To the Point.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
Warren Olney back with today's talking point. On her Twitter microblog, Nadia Tolokomikova says that Pussy Riot is in Sochi to record a musical film called Putin Will Teach You to Love the Motherland. She also claims that police in Sochi, quote, dragged me across the floor of the police station assembly hall office by my face, twisted my arms, and threw me to the floor. Michael Weiss is a fellow at the Institute of Modern Russia. He is editor-in-chief of The Interpreter, which is a daily online journal that translates Russian press reports into English. Michael Weiss, good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me.
Is that, in fact, an accurate translation of what she said?
Yes, it is. You know, recall that Pussy Riot first went to jail for close to 2 years for staging what they called a punk prayer in one of the main Orthodox Christian cathedrals in central Moscow. And the punk prayer was called Virgin Mary, Please Drive Out Putin, or something like that. So what they're doing is essentially an encore performance, or what they were attempting to do in Sochi was an encore performance. But, you know, I think this is actually the starkest indication of some of the stuff that had been said to be expected prior to Sochi, namely agitation, demonstrations against the human rights situation in Russia, because Pussy Riot, after being released from prison, went on a kind of global tour, including they came to my home city of New York and shared a stage with Madonna and Yoko Ono and were being feted, and now they go back to Russia and they get thrown in the clink for a couple hours for what seemed to be very clearly trumped-up charges. I think the police accused them of stealing something.
From their hotel, as I understand.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, what I find interesting about this is that they were even allowed into Sochi, or allowed into Adler in sort of an adjoining area close to the Olympic Village. The leader of the Russian opposition, Alexei Navalny, who had also been convicted on trumped-up charges of embezzlement in July, he has his travel within Russia restricted mostly to just Moscow and Moscow region. He can't even visit his parents in another area of the country. He was recently denied access to travel to Sochi, and this comes after he published a rather extensive expose into the corruption of, you know, where the $50 billion plus dollars on this Winter Olympics has been spent. So they want to keep people who have high visibility and high profile, particularly in the West, away from the center of action.
Well, nobody has a higher profile in the West now than these members of Pussy Riot. Do you think that because it has been relatively quiet, was Vladimir Putin lulled into complacency? It would seem to me that it would have been very consistent for him to say that this is not an appropriate place for them.
Well, actually, there have been quite a few cases, but again, taking place at the periphery or in the margins of Sochi. The leader of the Circassian movement, or the Circassian people, I should say, about 150 miles north of Sochi, just for your listeners, the Circassians, there's a Muslim sect in Russia that much like ethnic Chechens and English people are deeply upset about the location of this Olympics, you know, right in the heart of the Caucasus, their ancestral homeland, from which they were expelled by Joseph Stalin 70 years to the day when the closing ceremonies of this Olympics are due to take place, February 23rd. The Circassian leader in a city 150 miles north was arrested, and this is a man known to be on quite amenable, nodding terms with the government, doesn't really cause a fuss, and it seemed to be, quote-unquote, assimilated and moderate. So they are rounding up people, they are arresting people, including, I should add, a former member of Italian Parliament, I think a transgendered individual who had held up a sign that says gay is okay. And, of course, you know, the Russian Parliament passed a law last year banning what they call, quote, homosexual propaganda, claiming that this is aimed at eradicating pedophilia, but very clearly aimed at eradicating, you know, the human rights of all gay, lesbian, and transgender people in Russia. So, you know, foreigners have been arrested.
He was arrested and apparently did leave the country the following day.
Indeed, and was told you can't do this again. Don't even think about holding up another sign like this. So, but again, you know, as long as this sort of anti-establishment or anti-Putin agitation is taking place outside, you know, away from the NBC broadcast, away from the cameras, and all the focus is still on the athletic competitions, Putin will consider this a victory. So far, you know, there's not been a terrorist attack, which is one of the most sort of direly anticipated contingencies for Sochi, nor has a building collapsed or something, you know, terrible happened like that. I mean, we did all see, of course, Western journalists tweeting and Facebooking various embarrassing images of their as-yet-to-be-completed hotel rooms and hotels in some cases. But, I mean, that quickly subsided to give way to the coverage of the games, which so far, I have to say, have gone on pretty smoothly.
Right, but there certainly was, there were television cameras around Pussy Riot today when they were released from the jail in Sochi. If they're allowed to could stay there, no doubt they will attempt to do the film that we heard described or something else. So is it inevitable, do you think, as long as they're there, that there are going to be more confrontations like this?
As long as they're there, I would put an asterisk around. My guess is, and I haven't seen the latest, I mean, this is changing sort of by the minute, but
yeah,
my guess is they'll be ferried out of the area and told you can't come, you know, don't even think about coming back here. And, you know, again, it's rather brave of these girls. They spent 2 years in the gulag. I mean, let's be clear about what kind of prison conditions they were under. And they sort of transformed themselves, both in their own way, from being, you know, sort of feminist kind of punk performance artists into what I would consider on par with some of, you know, in line with the great tradition of Russian dissidents like Solzhenitsyn. I mean, if you
powerful prison reformers too.
Yes, indeed. I mean, the diaries that were kept, the letters, and the kind of good works that they were doing, calling attention to the miserable plight of Russian prisons, of Russian prisoners rather, has already affected some sort of moderate changes. So here they are, released, you know, a few months ago, and go right back to Russia, right back to the center of gravity right now to the country and its global image, and get thrown in jail. You know, so the idea that these are sort of frivolous, stupid right. young women, which has been peddled by both the regime and unfortunately by a lot of Western media, I've always said is false.
Okay.
And I, you know, if you look at even their courtroom statements when they were put on trial 2 years ago, some very powerful and philosophical messages they were putting forth there.
Michael Weiss, we're out of time for this segment. Thank you so much for being with us. Editor-in-Chief,
The
Interpreter, a daily online journal translating the media from the Russian into English. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast. It's a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.